Welcome to the Ultimate Aviators Podcast, where we pair a unique guest with an interesting question to help us master our craft and demystify the industry. I'm your host, Johnny Henderson, owner and operator of Harper Aviation, home of the Ultimate Knee Board. Let's get started. All right. Welcome to the Ultimate Aviators. Today I got Thad King, and we're going to be talking about what makes a special operations aviator. Thad, we connected over LinkedIn, so I got a little bit of your background here. So you're doing a podcast yourself and then consulting, and then why don't you tell us a little bit about your career that got you into special operations aviation?
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me. So I started out in the Army. I enlisted in 95, and I was actually a combat photographer. Was my very first MOS, and I don't really... I used to never share that with people, but I do now. And ended up going from there, kind of moving into the infantry. I was a lot younger then. Spent some time in the infantry and realized that, yeah, this is not the place that I want to spend my Army career. And although I love the mission, it just, you know, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room kind of thing. It was time to go. So, I became a diver, and then that was a great job in the Army. And, that's about the time that the Iraq invasion was about to happen, actually a little bit before that. And then, I put my packet in for flight school, and the war in Afghanistan was maybe like a year old. Maybe this was like September 2002, and I got picked up for flight school, and, I went to flight school and became a Black Hawk pilot, and just stayed in the Army the rest of my time. And I did a 15-month deployment in Iraq, and I remember it was the best of times and the worst of times. But I remember thinking, I will never do this again for 15 months straight. And I remember seeing like all the 160th guys just kind of coming in and coming out back and forth, and I was kind of stuck there for 15 months. And I always want, you know, you want to do more cooler things. And so, I put my packet in and favorably assessed, and then ended up there and spent 11 years in the regiment there in the 160th.
Man, and your back and neck have never been the same.
Yeah. I mean, it's, actually,
a couple years in.
Yeah. I don't have a ton of neck problems like a lot of pilots do. And my back is pretty good too. I'd say I probably do have more neck problems than back problems, but I've always used a weight bag. And so, I think maybe that helps. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in the same boat. I use a weight bag. And so the first question we'll tee up is what it's like to fly goggles hours on end. And I guess to preface that, I love flying goggles because I think it pairs cool flying with extra ability to support the ground force. So like I want to get good at that, and it's also fun, and then there's no traffic on my way home from work. But the difficulty of wearing goggles on end, like it's much more taxing. So what's it like from your position? You said you had how many goggle hours?
Like 2,300 maybe, some-ish.
Nice.
I kind of stopped counting, but... And I'm not saying that to, like, hey, look at me. It's just the older you get in your career, like, the less important those become. Not because you just don't need to track it as... I mean, I guess you probably really should, but even in the commercial world, if you're above certain amount of hour levels, like, at that point, it doesn't... It's not going to be a difference in pay or anything. So, yeah, for flying a lot of goggles, I think you just get used to it. I had flown a lot of goggles before I went to the 160th when I was in the regular Army or the big Army. And a lot of that happened in Iraq. I did 15 months in Iraq. And in that tour, I flew about 1,000 hours in that 15 months. And I don't know how many of that was goggles. Probably... maybe 500 of those. I spent a lot of time on nights because that's when all the assaults would happen. We did a few daytime assaults, but mostly nighttime. So I always kind of preferred flying at night, and it was cooler, like temperature wise cooler. So I think you kind of get used to it. You know, I think my longest goggle flight might be maybe 10 to 12 hour. I mean, like on a long range mission. But you just kind of, after a certain point, you just, you know, you get used to it. It's just kind of, you know, I remember when I was younger, like when I was, you know, sub 1,000 hours, like I would be very tired after like a 2 or 3 hour goggle flight. And then just got routine. And the 160th and training flights, they're usually 4 hour training flights, and they'll be all MBG, you know, sometimes 6 hour training flights. So you just kind of, eventually you just work up to it and you get used to flying that. And in that 15 months, if you were on nights, we would fly 6 hours a night. Every night we would max out, and, you know, day flights would be like eight hours, and then MBGs would be six. I mean, if you were on nights, you weren't landing without 6 hours in the books. And so, and that was at the height of the war in like 2006. So yeah, it just kind of you get used to it. It doesn't even faze me anymore.
Man, I got to train my bladder up to those types of flights.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, some guys, like, I can hold it for, I think you just think about other things. I don't, you know, some guys use like Gatorade bottles and stuff, and, or you can get those Air Force little pee things. But I would just, but a lot of times too, you know, when we're waiting for the ground force, or back in the day when I would wait for the ground guys, we just land out in the middle of nowhere and pull our own security, and then just get out and use the bathroom, you know? So,
yeah.
You know, out in the middle of the desert for nothing. You can see for 200 miles, you know, there's nothing out there. Nobody's really going to sneak up on you. So
how about your sleep schedule? I like flying goggles, but I've been waking up at 4:30, going to bed at 9:30 for like nearly 10 years. And I like being an early riser, but then anytime I fly goggles, I'm ruined for a week.
Yeah.
Have you become a night owl just based off of the job?
I kind of crushed my, like, the 160th, there's no schedule, you know, like you'll go from, and I think this is true in the conventional army too, active duty wise, it's not uncommon to be on, like, a Monday, be on a day shift, then Tuesday switch to nights, Wednesday nights, you know, maybe Thursday back to days, and Fridays back to days. And long term, that's super unhealthy, and I would not, don't be me after 24 years, and it'll wreck you. So now what I mean, I still fly MVGs now, but what I typically try to do is I have a set kind of window where typically I'll get up at 6:30 in the morning, and I'm usually trying to be in bed at 11. And so especially in the wintertime in the Northern Hemisphere, you can hit your goggles and be done, you know, by 8 o'clock. And in the summertime, unfortunately, like, I live in Florida, so it doesn't even get dark until, you know, 9 something, and, you know, the summer solstice. So that one is a little bit more difficult, where I'll only try to fly, you know, I'll do what I have to do, but typically, because my world right now is mostly training and test flights. So I'm usually down by, you know, 10:30, and I can be in the bed by midnight. So I try to keep the same sleep schedule if I can. There had been times that I would completely reverse out, like in the 160th when we were deployed. Yeah, we would be completely reversed out. You know, I'd usually typically get up at like 15:30, and then be in the office by 1700, and then conduct missions until like 4 a.m, and then hit the gym at like 4:30, and then be in the bed by, my goal was to always be in bed before the sun came up. So, cause once you see the sun rise, you know,
yeah,
your body's like, just kidding, I'm awake. So yeah, I would always try to be in bed before the sun came up.
I like it. And then, so pivoting to mission planning, I think that's where I think a lot of the respect for special operations comes from, is how much planning and then rehearsing goes into each of the missions. So can you walk us through what, like, planning for a typical mission would be? Obviously avoiding some of the sensitive details, but like the stuff that you emphasized to make sure that you had all your ducks in a row and were successful.
Yeah, I think that's what's important, is to delineate the difference between, you know, the Army and the 160th, or in aviation and all the other branches as well. Because in the 160th, you'll fly with all services. You'll support all services, and you'll fly with their guys too. And I think the planning makes the difference. And people will often say, like, oh, you guys just plan everything and never do anything. But the difference is in the mindset of how you think through a mission. It's not like cowboy up and go, which you probably, most people probably feel like that's what they do. But there is a lot of endless, you know, thought that goes into that. So I'd say typically a planning, you know, there's a 96-hour planning cycle, or, you know, a hasty planning cycle, which everybody's got their kind of definition of that. But I would say hasty would be anything less than 12 hours and more than 2 hours. Although we routinely did missions with less than, we would brief deliberate missions with less than 2 or 3 hours of planning, and we would support multiple customers. Like in the height of the war in Iraq, we would plan 2 or 3 missions. I'd infill one ground force, drop them off, come back, pick up a completely different team or different organization, put them in somewhere, you know, come back, and I've got both 2 battles going on. And then we'd, you know, when these guys are ready to come off the target, we'd flex to them and, you know, go all night like that and come back when the sun was coming up. But I would say for mission planning, usually, you know, you're going to start with really the whole crux of everything is the ground force commander's intent. Like, what do they want to happen? And then you build your plan around what their plan is and how to best support that. And, you know, you'll go from, you know, if I'm sure some folks listening to this are familiar with the military decision-making process. I mean, it's MDMP, just kind of with an aviation flair to it. So, you know, we go through that process, and then we go through all the, you know, but the difference, I think, between my time in the conventional Army and the 160th for planning purposes is we would go, you know, 6 layers deep in contingencies, whereas in the regular Army, we would usually stop at like inadvertent IMC. You know, there was never anything like, what if we ran out of gas, or what if there wasn't any, you know, so, or we would plan like IMC and there was never a recovery plan. It was always just the breakup part. Well, how do you get 6 aircraft back on the ground when there's a non-ATC environment? I think that's a big difference in planning, is you really go through, you know, everything that could possibly go wrong and build a plan up around that. And then more than likely when you go do the mission, nothing's going to go to what you planned, but at least you have a backup and you can kind of flex to that. And then it'll always be a little off, and then you just figure it out in real time. So that's probably
confidence is better when I plan, even if I don't use any of those details necessarily. I'm much more prepared mentally to handle changes.
It puts you, it's kind of a double-edged sword for me, because on one hand, being a good, there's kind of aviator skills, like natural aviator skills, where you can, you know, think through a problem very quickly. And then there's the planning skills that you deliberately go through, you know, what does this look like when things go bad? And the good thing about planning things is it lets you war game everything out to see where the holes in your plan are, rather than if you just go cowboying it up, which is a lot more fun, but
for sure
sometimes it could go wrong. So yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. And where were you based out of? Were you Savannah?
I started my career in Charlie Company 4th Battalion, which is the JBLM on the West Coast. Okay. And then I'm originally from the East Coast, and my wife was had our third kid when we were out at Fort Lewis, and we just didn't have any family there. And it was, you know, this was during the war. I was deployed. I was gone all the time. And she was like, "Hey, is there any way we could get back to the East Coast?" And so I asked, I said, "Hey, is there, can I?" And back then we didn't move battalions that much. It was kind of rare. But I talked to our senior warrant officer and he was like, "Yeah, whatever it takes to support the family, like, we're on board." So I was able to transfer to 3rd Battalion, which is in Savannah, which is only about 4 hours from where I grew up. And that we had a lot more support. Like, my dad lived 2 hours away from there, so we had a lot more support there. And I spent the remainder of my time, almost 8 years, in 3rd Battalion, in Charlie Company 3rd Battalion, there in Savannah. So
one of the things that I've heard is that the op tempo for 160th is obviously pretty incredible, but that is in turn matched with family support. And so you had mentioned, all right, anything for the family. Can you speak more to that family environment?
Yeah. I don't know what it's like now. I mean, I've been retired for some time. So, and the wars are kind of, they're still right, operating, yeah, but not like it was back in the day. But the real difference is there's no cycle. Like, SEAL teams have a very deliberate cycle where they train, they work up, they do a big exercise, then they deploy for 6 months, and then they starburst, and the cycle starts again. MARSOC is almost carbon copy, very, very similar to how SEAL teams operate. And even the Ranger Regiment has a very, you know, you could plan in 3 years where 3rd Ranger Battalion is going to be. And SF is not as great, as predictable as those other units, but the 160th, none of that exists. There is no cycle. It's because you're pulled every which way. Everybody wants black helicopters. So you're always, if you're not conducting combat operations, you're at Fort Bragg or you're in Little Creek, or if you're on the West Coast, you're down in North Island in San Diego. You're always supporting somebody, training, getting ready to go. And so for the families, they have a pretty robust FRG, I think they strike usually a pretty good balance of like being overbearing and, because a lot of times in FRG in the regular army, like, you just get all kinds of drama. Like, some spouses want their spouse's rank, or they act like, yeah, it gets sideways with spouses, and so you don't really see that a lot in the 160th. I mean, it happens, but there's tons of family things that they do for the families. There's always, you know, spouse flights and family day. There's like usually twice a year we'll have like a family day, once during what they call Wanza, week of no scheduled activities. It's like a whole week stand down where it's just nothing but playing baseball or softball and, you know, golf, and just kind of just a whole week of, and then it culminates with a formal at the end. And each battalion will have their own, you know, Savannah has Swanza, which is Savannah week of no scheduled activities. And there's Fort Campbell, which is 1st and 2nd battalion. They just have Wanza, and then JBLM has Wanza West. So, and then there's always like a big Christmas party that they even give the kids presents. Typically each company will buy all the kids in the company presents. Like, my kids have memories of going to my company and opening presents there, you know, like the 18th of December or something like that. So there's a pretty good network of spouses. The other difference is usually, depending on what your like TRICARE preferences, a lot of times your medical team that supports you supports your family. So when you're gone, you know, your wife, like my wife for years had my flight surgeon's cell phone number and could just say, call him and say, "Hey, the kids are sick. You know, they'll come to your house." They used to come to our house, or they would, you know, "Hey, what's the symptoms? Okay, I'll call in a prescription. You can go pick it up." So things like that, like while the guys are deployed or the girls are deployed, that the families can pick up the phone and talk to that's not all the time. I mean, who knows what it's like now, but back then, they could call, my wife would just call the surgeon and say, hey, should I bring the kids in for this? Yeah. Okay. Bring them in. Or, you know, even like on a Saturday, hey, yeah, bring them to the hangar. I'll meet you there. And, you know, so that's the kind of a little bit different than what you'd find, in a conventional unit. Yeah. Not that I've not had that before. Like when I was in Korea, we had a flight surgeon that was like that, but, you don't
typically see that. My wife's favorite interactions with the military were flight school, where everyone lived in close proximity. Everyone's husbands typically had the same schedule, you know, various stages of flight school. And then no one had family nearby. So everyone just bonded and looked after one another. And when one husband was gone at sea year, then everyone would invite their kids over for that couple weeks and things like that. So,
yeah, it's a little weird. It kind of goes in phases of where people live, because each base you can live like 40 minutes apart, you know, so it kind of depends on when you get in a unit where everybody's living, you know, to have that. Like when I first got to 3rd Battalion, I knew all those guys from when I was in 4th Battalion because I was always deploying with them, and they all lived in one city. By the time I got to 3rd Battalion, I had it in my head that's where I was going to move. So I moved there, but there was only like two guys left there, and everybody else had moved to like a newer part of Savannah. And so, and now everybody lives in the town where I live. So, I mean, it just kind of goes in cycles, but, you know, I'd say the families are generally really well taken care of. I don't know how much they hang out together, because you're typically with these guys more than you are with your family. And a lot of times the last thing you want to do is like hang out with the people that you're always with. But, you know, usually, you know, you'd have like a good bro or something that lives close that you do stuff with on the weekends or whatever. So
what other force multipliers help you do that type of mission? So we talked about family. What else really made the difference?
For me,
160th.
I think for me, they have embedded behavioral health. It's not called, it used to be called Thor 3. It's not called that anyway anymore. But basically, you have a physical therapy guy, a strength and conditioning coach, a psychologist, and a cognitive behavioral therapist. And they're organic to your battalion. And so it's kind of like a mind, body, spirit kind of setup, where some positions are command regulated, like you will go to the psychologist. You know, you typically, like commanders, flight leads will have to do some version of a check-in with the command psychologist, you know, annually or twice a year or something. It's probably changed now, but, and then other MOSs and jobs as you need it. But I would say, like, for me, having that, the psychologist that we had, she's still there, top notch. She really was able to help me kind of get through some of those, you know, there's a lot of mental things that happen in that organization that you have to be really resilient and mentally tough, it's a lot easier when you have somebody kind of guiding you through that. And I think they do a very good job. The Ranger Regiment does too. The Rangers have the same, everybody in SOF has the same setup. Typically though, the 160th will have them at the battalion level, whereas like SEAL teams will have those same people, but at the group level. So like, you know, a SEAL team's roughly the size of a battalion. So you might have like five SEAL teams with like four people, where the 160th will have four people for one battalion. So, you mean it's really good. I think that for me, you know, they design nutrition plans, workout plans. If you're injured, I got injured in Iraq in 11, and they tailor made me a workout plan to work around my injuries. And hey, this is here's your workout plan. Here's your meal plan, you know, to get you back on track. And then, so things like that are kind of pretty nice and pretty sweet, Jim.
Yeah.
If you like to lift weights.
For sure. Well, I think it's cool that maybe Special Forces understands a lot of the preventative stuff
Yeah.
that the rest of the army could benefit from. That I think conventional armies, like, we'll fix it on the back end, but a
Yeah.
lot of those things are,
It's
let's
a
get ahead of
human
this.
capital thing. Like, they understand that. And so, and not to mention, it's just protecting the investment. It takes a long time to get in that organization to, as a pilot, to be an FMQ is, you're looking at least a 2-year process, and flight lead is going to be another 5 years. So, when you look at that, how much they've invested in the individual, these little preventative things are a drop in the bucket of how much it costs to, preserve the longevity of, their investment.
For sure. So I guess going to more some of the operational stuff, has there been a time where split second decision making has made the difference for you or affected a mission where you look back and you're like, oh, that was a crucial point where it could have gone differently?
Yeah, I don't know that that happened when I was in the 160th, and I'll kind of tie it back to why I say that. In the 160th, everything is generally speaking planned down to the finite detail. So in my instances where it went kinetic, where we're engaging enemy, wasn't that it wasn't as much as I had in the regular army. Not because it was any more or less dangerous. It's just we kind of picked the time and the place where, and everything was taken to mitigate that happening. For me, a time, and I don't know if you want it from the conventional army or not, but
Sure, yeah.
I did a mission. It was in September of 2007. And it's called Operation Chromium. You can Google it if your listeners want to read about it. And at the time, I didn't even know that it. I mean, up until like November, I did not know that this mission had a bunch of stories written about it. And the guys that were on the target got a Distinguished Service Cross. And one of the guys, Master Sergeant Jerrion, Halbinson Gibbs, I always screw his last name up. They're trying to make his Distinguished Service Cross a Medal of Honor. And so on that mission, I was the lead aircraft, and we were hitting believe it or not, it was the Islamic State in Iraq. They were around back in 07, and we were just north of Balad, Iraq. And we were inbound to the target, or it was an offset LZ. So I don't know if people were familiar with offsets, but essentially we weren't going to land right near where the action was going to take place. We were going to land off site, and they were going to walk in that way so they don't spook the guys we're trying to capture or kill. And as we're going in, the attack weapons team, we had two Apaches from 182 out of Fort Bragg, or whatever it's called. I guess it's back to Fort Bragg now. The red, they were, re the, if you want to really nerd out, in 182, 1st Battalion, 82nd Aviation, they have A, B, and C companies. I think it's like Red Wolf, White Wolf, and Blue Wolf, like Red, White, and Blue Wolf. So these guys were from Red Wolf. I think they were A company dudes. Or I might have the colors backwards, but it was definitely
Sure.
Red Wolf. And they had radioed and said, "Hey, your LZs are flooded. There's standing water in the LZs." And that was kind of like a TTP, so like you couldn't land there. So I had looked at the imagery and said, the ground force commander was on my bird, a guy named Captain Cheney, and I said, "Hey," and this was a 10th Special Forces group ground guys, and I said, "Hey, the LZs are flooded, but if you want, I can land inside the compound, and I can put you at the front door of the building." I was like, "You're going to be right on top of them, but we'll have the element of surprise." And we're like inbound to the
Yeah.
target. We're like
You're like,
10
I need your
minutes
answer in
away.
10 seconds.
Yeah. And he was like, he radios to his team and they're like, yeah, let's do it. So in flight, we kind of recock everything. We're a flight of two Blackhawks, and we had an ODA and a reinforced Iraqi, you know, basically like an Iraqi platoon and a, not even that, like two squads of Iraqi guys and a special forces team. I think we probably had like, I don't know, maybe 18, 24 guys, maybe 22 guys, probably 22 because it's 11 and 11. So that can fit in, with the seats in. So we made the last minute decision to switch, and I landed it in the courtyard. If you want to hear the super detailed story, you can go on our podcast, Alone and Unafraid. It's episode 44 with Daryl Utt, if you want to hear the play-by-play. But basically, the rotor disc, the door was probably, I'm guessing, like 10 feet outside the rotor disc from where the, you know, where the blades were to the front door of the house. And they were able to make entry, but when they entered the house, they immediately took contact and ended up with three casualties, not killed in action, unbeknownst to us. We didn't know. I didn't know until November of last year, you know, 18 years later, that all three of those guys survived. But that decision probably caused them to get injured. And that was a decision that was made by me as the flight lead of that, by the air mission commander and by the ground force commander. And, you know, we all kind of have to own that. But the jig was up. They knew as soon as we were, you know, landing, they could hear us, and they had a PKM and a bunch of, they were ready to fight. And so, and these guys were diehard, you know, ISIS dudes before ISIS was like a thing. And so as soon as we went in, as soon as I was coming out, I mean, I saw them get kind of blown up out of the building with a grenade went off, and they went out. Two of the guys came out of the building, and I was talking to the JTAC, and he said that they had casualties. So I'd maybe gone like a half mile away and just flipped a 180 and went right back in there to load up the wounded. And again, in retrospect, because that was like my first real CASAVAC under like a hot LZ, like ultra kinetic, like my 9mm out the window. And it was crazy. But the whole time the attack weapons team was screaming, get out of the way, we need to shoot, get out of the way. And they couldn't put effective fires on because I was in the way loading the wounded. In reality, it was so danger close anyway, because we were fighting house to house with about maybe 20 meters between each houses, the two houses that were, like, I attempted to land to put the helicopter between the good guys and the bad guys, but there was a tree in the way, so I couldn't really get where I wanted to get, so I kind of had to go where I originally went. And I don't think the Apache guys could have, it was so crazy because they were so close, you couldn't tell who. The only way I could tell the bad guys is they had man dresses on. Like, I couldn't tell if Americans were in the same building as they are. So in reality, I don't think those guys could have really shot with rockets or 30 millimeter, because it would have just been danger close, and like everybody was everywhere. It was chaos. And so to sum it up is like, the 1/60th version of me that is a little bit more senior, I would have immediately waved off and held and kind of developed a more better tactical plan to say, hey, let's just don't go cowboy in there. Maybe we live to fight another day, or, you know, let's hold off, you know, 5 miles away and talk through this, what could go wrong before we go blazing in there. But that's not how that went down. And luckily, all three of those guys lived. We came back and CASAVAC'd them, took them to the hospital, which, funny enough, there was nobody waiting for us. So my crew chiefs and me carried these guys into the hospital. It was a crazy mission. But now two of those guys got Silver Stars. The Jarian got a Distinguished Service Cross. He's up for a Medal of Honor now. And then my two crew chiefs, they both got Bronze Stars with Valor because they were my crew chiefs got out of the aircraft to retrieve the wounded. Were running through like bullets, and unfortunately, my left gun crew chief, a guy named Chris Elliott, he eventually went on to be a commercial pilot and was flying jets and doing great. And I think things just got too tough for him, and he ended up taking his own life just in February this year. So,
oh, man.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm sure there was a lot of other things going on, but Chris was elbow deep in blood in the back of that helicopter working on Americans. And I'm sure some version of that night, you know, I don't want to say haunted him, because he was a hero. I mean, he saved those dudes' lives. And, but yeah, so that's a decision that kind of, well, I'll have to live with that the rest of my life, you know?
Yeah.
I think it worked out, but you know, it could have been better.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being so vulnerable. I'll link to episode 44 and I'll go listen to that myself. That's awesome that everyone's getting the recognition commensurate with the duties they performed.
Yeah.
Well, right at 35 minutes. So why don't we do some wrap up here?
Yeah.
Obviously, I think a lot of your roles in 160th don't take you to airports necessarily, but in more of a lightning round, do you have a favorite airport that you've been to? What made the trip? Or I know you guys are TDY all the time, so maybe the right FBO. Yeah.
I'd probably say McCarran in Vegas. Is it even called McCarran anymore? I think it's called Harry Reid International now. The one in Vegas. So that,
oh yeah.
Yeah, the one right on the strip. And if you're a helicopter guy and you ever do that, if you ever do that transition. Sorry about that. If you ever do that transition, you end up flying right down the strip, and then you make your base turn essentially over the FBO, and you land, kind of hover down. And after my flight lead ride, we flew from Savannah to Buckley. Are you at Buckley?
I am.
Is that where you're out of? Yeah. So we stayed with
them pretty regularly too.
Yeah, we stayed with the Colorado Guard there at Buckley in that really nice facility they have. And then we took off out of Buckley. I actually ended up, it was a really terrible snowstorm, and I was trying to get out to California, and I ended up landing in Kit Carson Airport in Kansas, which is east of Denver, west of Denver, just because the snow was so bad. We were like landing in farmers' fields all night long trying to get to New Mexico. We just couldn't get there. So we ended up staying overnight in Kit Carson. And although a tiny FBO, we drained that guy's fuel. We made his whole year because we filled three Blackhawks up with our aux tanks. And it was great. But yeah, I'd probably say Vegas is the approach into there for helicopters is right down the strip. So it's pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah, I think anytime you get to fly around populated areas, you're a little more aware of what's going on because it matters more. It's not just airport in the middle of nowhere, but also there's way more to see. And maybe
we picked that on purpose. Like,
yeah,
that was our I convinced my commander that if I passed the eval to let me take everybody to Vegas. And he's like, I don't care what you do, just be back on this day and you can stay wherever you want. And I was like, Roger, we're going to Vegas. And we went to Vegas and we had a great time.
Nice. So being a Black Hawk guy, and then even afterwards, you got out and continued flying Black Hawks through your consulting gig, right? Is there an aircraft that you still dream of flying someday? Or if it was like, hey, if I could be paired with someone and get an hour in this aircraft, that would be awesome.
I don't really have, you know, at some point, like, flying becomes labor. And although I love it still, and I you know, when I left the Army, I went to the State Department, and I set up the State Department's Black Hawk program, and I worked there for 6 years. And I'd probably say if I could go back to, if I could fly anything, you know, fighter jets are cool. I think I'd probably get sick though. I've kind of always wanted to fly a tandem, you know, like an Apache or Cobra or something. But if I only could fly one other helicopter ever again, and I was given the opportunity, it would be an MH-60 Mike, just because there's nothing like that helicopter on, and it's the difference between an MH Mike and a UH Mike is like other world. Like it's on another level that, of impressibility, if that's a word, impressibility. But yeah,
what I, failed to ask this before, but what models of Mike or, Blackhawks have you flown?
Alpha, UH-60 Alphas, Limas, Alpha Plus, HH-60 Limas, MH-60 Limas, and MH-60 Mikes.
Okay. I've only ever been most, 60 Lima.
Yeah, yeah. Back in the old days, we had A models that with a T-700 engine, which I still actually fly an A model in my consulting job. I fly and I kind of forget sometimes when I look down at the TGT. It and there's some things with A models that Lima models you don't have to worry about, and so sometimes I forget when I'm flying that thing. And yeah,
nice. Yeah, I'm not Mike qualified yet, but everyone coming back from flight school right now is, so then we gotta retrograde them to the Lima.
Oh, okay.
And then maybe just in closing, what's one myth about special operations you'd love to debunk or clarify?
Yeah, aviation or just special operations in general? Probably
up to you.
I'll stick with aviation. With the 160th is, I'd probably say that the myth is, which is sort of not really a myth, but kind of a myth, is there's a lot of ego in that organization, but it's for a good reason. But typically the guys that you find, especially in the Army, that are no longer in that organization, there's probably a good reason that they're not in that organization. And it could be like it's typically standard based. It's like they just weren't cutting the standards, and that organization has the ability to jettison those who don't earn it every day. And or it could just be a personality thing, like they just don't fit in with the team, and they're good pilots and they're good people. It's just they're not a good fit for the team, and it hurts the team dynamic, so the organization will choose to jettison those folks. So a lot of times those folks go out to the conventional forces, and they will maybe their worldview of that organization is a little bit jaded or different than the folks that stay in the organization. So I would probably say, like, if there was a myth, is that they're all full of egomaniacs and crazies. And although that's not entirely not, I mean, that's somewhat accurate to some degree, but typically you'll find, like, generally very humble, ultra professional, really smart people that would literally probably rather die than quit. And that's, you know, it's part of the motto, but I think that's probably a myth that these guys are. And the other thing is, I used to hear this all the time, like, you guys never listen to the radios and you guys never monitor anything, you just do what you want. And it's not that they're doing what they want because they're cowboys. They might be working six or seven different battle spaces between, you know, in a combat area. They might flex, you know, typically an Army unit's going to work one geographic area of operation their entire deployment. The 160th, one deployment I'm in Africa, the next one I'm in Iraq, the next one I'm in Afghanistan. I'm in real time figuring out the lay of the land as I'm doing the mission. So yeah, a lot of times, like, we'll go into a FARP and not know that the FARP frequency is whatever it is, just because we never operated there before. It's like day one for us. And, you know, so a lot of guys are like, these guys are just cowboys. No, dude, they got like seven radios going on and nobody cares about the FARP because international signal for I need gas is a helicopter lands and you put gas in there. So a lot of times, like, they can't sweat the small stuff just because they have a big mission going on and they need all seven radios to monitor that flight, or they probably just don't know that there's a frequency because that's the first time they've ever been there. So even though you've seen black helicopters come in and out of there, that's a different crew from a different battalion, or a lot of times you'll have two dudes in the helicopter from one battalion, two dudes from another battalion, or I've had a helicopter that had all four crew from all four battalions. Like, because we have one SOP, it's the same in every company you go to. Every battalion, every company does things exactly the same way, with some subtle, some companies have their own little flair that they're going to put on things. But by and large, in the 160th, any company in the 160th, airframe agnostic, Chinooks, Little Birds, MQ-9s, Blackhawks, all will do business 98% the same exact way. And so it's super easy to plug and play. And that's typically how we would deploy, is, all mixed up or as part of a, ad hoc task force or something.
Man, well, thanks for that. This has been awesome. It's been cool to get to learn more about special aviation and the mission that 160th does for us. Anything else you want to plug at the end, where people can find you? And I know you got a podcast.
If you want to listen to our podcast, I host it with a former crew chief from the 160th. I was a Blackhawk pilot. He was a 47 crew chief. We were in the same battalion. And then we know each other. Everybody in the different airframes knows each other. You fly with those guys all the time. They become your friends. So we have a podcast called Alone and Unafraid. You can find us anywhere you listen to podcasts. You can go to our website, aloneandunafraid.org. We're also on Instagram, LinkedIn, and TikTok. And really, our podcast is really about kind of mental health and post-service, or the in-between times when you're not, when you're trying to figure it out. All the things that nobody really wants to talk about that military folks struggle with, we'll have those kind of hard conversations. And sometimes it's a lot of fun. I get a lot out of it. Other times it's really, really uncomfortable, but sometimes you just got to kind of put it out there a little bit to help folks. And if we can help change the narrative for future air crew, or basically have the future guys not make the same mistakes that we did, that's kind of the goal, is to be a little bit better than we were. So check us out, Alone and Unafraid, wherever you get your podcast.
Thanks, Ed. Yeah, I appreciate it. And thanks for coming on.
Yeah, anytime.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
All right, see ya.
Thanks for joining us on the Ultimate Aviators Podcast. Professionals use professional tools, and you can visit ultimateknee.com for your aviation needs. Additionally, visit harperaviation.com/gifts to find your special aviator something nice. Music was by The Fat Rat. Until next time, clear skies.